Dr. Pipes, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Greg.
So I know that you've written on Venezuela in an article that took place in the Wall Street Journal. We don't have to talk about that so much, but you've commented recently on the commonality of a instance that actually happened where Venezuela had shipped $900 million in gold to Turkey, a country which, if we compare the two systems of government, is very much like Venezuela. Speaking about Turkey itself, this is a country which you have been covering extensively for decades. And I was hoping to start off our interview with you giving an impression of what is President Erdogan's current position in that country, and what is he doing right now to consolidate power if he hasn't already, and how should the West look at him?
Well, he consolidated power a long time ago. I would say the last real election was in 2014, and since then they have been mock elections where you know the outcome in advance, you just don't know what the numbers are going to be. He is a tyrant. If you say anything, if you sign a petition protesting something or other, you might well find yourself in jail. Now, it's not the worst of the tyrannies. It is not as brutal, as crazed as others, but it is a tyranny. And there are many consequences from that, including an economic decline, which is ironic because Erdogan established himself on the basis of his economic success. And now his fighting the interest rates, his erratic foreign policy, his oppressive domestic policy have all caused foreign direct investors to hesitate to put their money in Turkey, and the results are clear: a decline in the currency and much else.
So you've been quoted as saying that while Iran is the main threat to U.S. national security interests in the Middle East today, Turkey is the threat of tomorrow. Can you elaborate on that statement?
Well, Iran is clearly the greatest threat today, the building of nuclear weapons, the export of extremist Islamist ideology, the low-grade jihadi violence, and so forth. Turkey is not a threat in the same way. They're not building nuclear weapons and so forth. But they are building an indigenous military capacity, military industrial capacity, and they are ever more unfriendly to us. So I see Iran, this month is Iran's 40th anniversary, or the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I just yesterday predicted that there won't be a 50th anniversary, that the regime is not going to survive. It's going out on a limb, but I think it's in a pre-revolutionary state right now. And all that's needed is a leader to emerge. For example, the son of the last Shah is someone who is eager to fill that capacity. And maybe the Iranians will turn to him or to someone else. Once it happens, I see the regime as very fragile and vulnerable and likely to be overthrown, in which case the Iranian people, government, will not be an enemy of the United States, but Turkey will stand out as the problem for Americans.
So it's interesting that we're bringing up Iran right now because there's a gathering of world leaders, specifically those from the West who have a somewhat anti-Iranian position or anti-Iranian government position, and those coming from the Middle East. I believe it's actually the first time that we have an Israeli prime minister and other Arab foreign ministers meeting in a Western capital. I'm speaking about Warsaw, joined by John Bolton, the U.S. National Security Advisor, Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And the subject of the two-day gathering is Iran. What do you expect to come out of this conclave in Warsaw? And what can it do to help propel to make sure the situation doesn't emerge where there is a 50th anniversary of the Islamic Republic?
It is basically a conclave of American allies that agree with the U.S. position, the pulling out of the Iran deal, the tough attitude towards Tehran. I think it will enhance that position slightly, but not a great deal. it'll be clear that all sorts of powers are not there, are not in agreement. So I don't see it as too significant.
Also on the sidelines of this conference, it's been reported that U.S. Special Envoy for the Peace Process, Jason Greenblatt, Jared Kushner, another envoy, President Trump's son-in-law, and other American officials will be presenting their initial ideas of what a Israeli-Palestinian peace accord might look like. And I know that you have had some opinions on this subject, but in general, what do you think is going to be the subject of conversation between those Arab foreign ministers, the Israeli representative, and the American officials, especially pointing out that no Palestinian, even though they were invited, agreed to come to this conference?
Well, not only did they not agree, but they urged others not to go as well. As I see it, Trump's emphasis is on putting together a posse to take care of Iran, so-called Middle East NATO. And he is doing everything he can to have good relations with the Saudis, including yesterday not submitting the analysis required by Congress of what happened with Khashoggi. He just didn't want to go into that subject. Also, getting the Israelis' goodwill by moving the embassy to Jerusalem, and so far unsuccessfully trying to get Palestinian goodwill by giving them a whole lot of things they want, in particular recognition, U.S. recognition of the state of Palestine, with Jerusalem's capital. For reasons having to do with the temperament of Mahmoud Abbas and the dynamics of intra-Palestinian politics, where Hamas is all the time breathing down the neck of the Palestinian Authority, the PA is not going to the table. And this is frustrating the American side, which wants to get the Arab, Palestinian-Israeli conflict wrapped up so that everyone, all the states, the Saudis and others, can move against, put pressure on Iran. So the Palestinians are the lion linemen. They're the ones who are involved. They're the ones who are causing this effort to be impeded.
And it's not just the United States which is feeling frustrated because of this internecine intra-Palestinian rivalry, but we also see other countries in the region trying to take advantage of the split in Palestinian leadership. With a report that came out yesterday, I believe, about over $1 billion being granted to the Hamas terrorist government in Gaza by the nation state of Qatar. Now, I know since 2012, I know that this has been a subject that our organization has focused on for the last few months, if not the last few years, the Qatari influence operations in the Middle East and their ambitions and the reason and rationale for them getting involved. But specifically on the Hamas portion, why do we have an Arab government funneling over $1 billion to a polity which is ostensibly anti-Western when they are trying to come off as pro-Western?
There's an easy answer, and there's a difficult. You have an easy question, and a difficult question. The easy question is to answer is the Qataris are playing a double game, where they have an enormous American air base and fund all sorts of educational efforts in the West and Katrina aid and the like to win our support, our approval. On the other hand, it is an Islamist, even a Wahhabi government that wants to support the Islamist movement. So it's doing both at the same time. That's the easy part. The difficult part is why is Qatar a very fragile, very vulnerable state? I should not say fragile, a very vulnerable state with this gigantic gas field, with a tiny population in a very difficult region surrounded by Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia. Why is it helping revolutionary causes? Why is Al Jazeera and the money it spends and the arms it provides going to the forces of insurrection? When you think that's the last thing the Qataris want, they want to keep things quiet. They're a commercial hub. They have things to sell. And yet they do. And I can only ascribe this to the character of both the prior leader and the Ahmad and the current one to me. I don't think there's a rational thing.
Now, there's also the idea here that it's not just Qatar which should be held responsible for its malign activities in the Middle East and going beyond that, almost on a global level. But there's also some countries and governments that the U.S. considers to be its allies that are playing ball with the Qataris. For instance, I don't think that it would have been possible for $1 billion to have been transferred to Hamas by Qatar and its representatives without a wink and a nod, or at least the full-blown acquiescence of the Israeli government. So Israel considers Hamas to be a illegitimate actor and does not necessarily call for it to be overthrown, but calls to be held to account. It bombs it whenever it gets rocketed by them. It puts its members in the West in the West Bank in jail for financing terror activity and for being a member of a terror organization. Israel is all out against Hamas, at least so it says publicly. But then the latest transfer of cash was $15 million a month in three suitcases going from an Israeli-controlled checkpoint in Erez, which is at the northeast side of the Gaza Strip, into Gaza to fund not the humanitarian quotes, and I use that term very, very lightly, but also Hamas salaries in the Gaza Strip. So in your opinion, two questions. One, why are the Israelis allowing this to happen? And two, if you disagree with them allowing it to happen, what should be the position of the Israeli government as it relates to allowing Qatari support for Hamas?
It happens because the Israeli security establishment, the army, the intelligence services, the law enforcement, generally are inclined to seek quiet. They don't want problems. They are very short-term. They're very timid. It's very status quo. And so getting money for the Palestinians, whether it be through UNRWA or from Qatar or other sources, is in itself a good thing because if the Palestinians have funds, they are less likely to erupt in an intifada, overthrow the Palestinian Authority or other steps. As I say, it's very short term. It's myopic even. What they're not doing is looking at the larger picture, which would require a very different approach. My suggested approach, that of Israel victory, would be to cause the Palestinians to realize that their effort to eliminate the Jewish state of Israel is hopeless and that they should give it up. And that would be done in a very different way. One simple illustration would be for the Israelis to say to Hamas, you send over the first missile and you get cut off from everything coming from Israel, food, water, medicine, electricity, for one day. You send over a second one, you get cut off for 2 days, etc. I think Hamas would quickly realize it can't do this, and it would start to behave. There can be many other steps along these lines. The Israelis have enormous power. They're not using it. They're appeasing, they're hoping for quiet, and it's not working.
So I know that the Middle East Forum has been quite active in reaching out to Israeli politicians, members of the security establishment, the public, even going so far to engage with youth groups, with veterans organizations, the supporters of widow and terror victims who were affected by organizations on the other side of the Gaza border or those terror cells in the West Bank. On April 9th, we have the elections for a new Knesset. Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister of Israel, putting his corruption investigations aside, is facing a very formidable challenge in the presence of former Israeli Defense Forces Chief of Staff Benny Gantz. And I think that if I was going to ask you one thing that you would ask out of any individual party list candidate that's running for office in terms of Israel victory, what would you want to see a member of Knesset say in the run-up to this election?
Well, a number of party leaders near leaders like Gideon Saar, Avigdor Lieberman, Naftali Bennett, right, have spoken about Israel needing to win. Those are the magic words for me. Any Israeli who talks about winning, specific group is on the right track. Anyone who talks, as Benny Gantz seems to have done, about the 2005 withdrawal from Gaza being an exemplary action, presumably something to be emulated on the West Bank in the future, is wrong.
Right. Let's invite a final victory here rather than continuing war after war. And just your last thoughts, Mr. Pipes, on the 25th anniversary of the Middle East Forum. Congratulations to our organization on this seminal moment. And any thoughts to share with our listeners before we part ways?
Well, yes, we just celebrated the actual day in late January, and we'll be having an event to celebrate it in May in New York. So much has changed. For example, the internet. There was no internet to speak of in 1994, or this marginal. We have taken up new topics, such as Islam in the West. But the fundamental issues of the Middle East are achingly familiar. Iran, Arab Israel, Islamism, and so forth. Whilst there is some good news, there's also definitely bad news. Certainly Saudi Arabia's, I think, potentially good news. Turkey is definitely bad news. So not any huge changes in the course of 25 years.
Mr. Pipes, congratulations again to you and to the forum, and we look forward to having you again on the program.